Please note that due to the adult nature of this topic, this show is not recommended for children or sensitive listeners.
This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning and thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. They are unequivocally the most hated members of society. I'm talking about paedophiles. We often only know who they are if and when a child has been molested. I want to understand paedophilia. Is it a fetish? Is it an illness? Or is it a choice? If we can understand it, we can help protect the vulnerable in our communities. And the best way to understand paedophilia and to get inside the head of a paedophile is to speak to a paedophile. Joining me now is Bly Reed. Good morning, Bly, and thank you so much for the time.
Good morning, thank you.
Are paedophiles made or born?
We don't know for certain, and obviously I'm not a scientist, and so it's difficult for me to know the answers on that. But most people like me who you would ask would probably say it's born. In the sense that some of us, when we get the chance to compare notes, find that we have significant experiences in our past. But when you try to find a single pattern or a reliable pattern of past experiences, we don't all have the same experiences. There isn't one thing you could point to that says, oh, that's the moment I became a pedophile. And we also know that some scientists are looking into the matter and their best theories at the moment from the people who've really looked at this in a biological sense are that this is something that probably starts in the womb, actually, not necessarily before conception, but that it happens as a hormonal process in the womb. Like everybody who has any characteristic, most of us don't know where it comes from. We just know we've got it and we've got to live with it, you know.
How old were you when you realized that you were a paedophile?
I would have been about 14 or 15, which is fairly typical. The only reason I'm not certain of that is because it didn't sort of just come like a thunderclap one day and I just sort of suddenly realized. But it was a sort of gradual process of realization. And my realization was probably fairly typical in that I started by being attracted to my peers, as you are when you start puberty. And then it was only after a few years of that that I started to notice that I was still attracted to the same ages that I'd been attracted to when I was that young myself, you know, at 11 or 12 or so. And around that time also, suddenly I started to notice that I was capable of finding attractive even younger kids, boys in my case.
Do you have an age range that you're specifically attracted to?
Yes, it is. I'm what's called a non-exclusive, which means that I'm non-exclusively attracted to children, which means that I'm somewhat attracted to adults as well, or in fact quite a bit, depending on the adult. But my what they call the age of attraction starts at around 7-ish and then goes up to around sort of 30-ish, and I'm now in my 40s, so it's not my peers anymore. Also, there's a little bit of variation in that different features of different kids can be attractive at different ages, and so sometimes I can be attracted to younger kids, to their faces, for example, rather than other aspects of them.
Give me an example of different aspects that are attractive in children at different ages.
Okay, well, so for example, a child's body plan changes throughout their sort of development, and you know, those are known as Tanner stages, actually, in relation to puberty. And so it might be that between that sort of 7 and the onset of puberty, that's one type of body plan. And before that, it's another type. The stomach might be a different shape, or, you know, limbs might not be as thin, or those sorts of things. So those different aspects affect whether somebody's attractive in the same way that, for example, if you're a teleophile, which means somebody who's attracted to adults, if you were, say, a heterosexual woman, you know, the accumulation of muscle mass might be the thing that makes the difference and makes you start to be attracted to men, the different shapes that the body plans that men have. It's the same principle that it works on. It's just that it doesn't work as evolution planned, if you like. Not that evolution planned it, but you know what I mean.
Like, how common is paedophilia? Do you have stats?
We don't have reliable stats. And one of the reasons for that is that people like us don't tend to sort of identify ourselves. But there have been some attempts to estimate it. And a scientist called Michael Seto has come up with different estimates, actually, at different times in his career. They've ranged between about 1% to possibly as high as 5% of the male population. And by which I assume he means internationally, you know, not just in the area where he was investigating that. And what he was trying to describe by that statistic was those who have a principal attraction to prepubescent children. In other words, the people who prepubescent children are the people they are most sexually attracted to. So that doesn't include, for example, people for whom it's mainly teenagers. And it doesn't include people who are attracted to adults and children, but more to adults. So that's quite a startling statistic if you take the high number. I think he probably wouldn't support the high number anymore, of 5%, which would be 1 in 20 people. But let's say you go with the low number of about 1%, 1 in 100 people, or you even are a bit more cautious than that and say maybe he's overestimated and we go with 0.5% of males, then of course that's 1 in 200 males. There aren't statistics for females. We know they exist because some of them are members at Virtuous Pedophiles. But we do think that they, experience it roughly the same from their self-description as the males do. The scientists haven't sort of, as it were, shown that that exists in the lab yet. So they tend not to talk about female pedophiles, but we've met some. So what that means really is that chances are, if you're listening to this show and you're a human being, you know one of us. You're acquainted at least with one of us. I don't know how many sort of average acquaintances the average human being has, but it probably exceeds 200, certainly over the course of a lifetime. And that means therefore that you've probably shared a classroom with one of us when you were a child. You've probably sat down to a meal with one of us. You've probably shared a joke with one of us. You've probably been served in a shop by one of us. You've probably encountered us professionally. You've sat in a meeting with one of us. We don't fully know the stat, but I find that stat plausible. Obviously, as I think we've probably already said, you know, the slice of that population that we ever get to know about is those who not only offend, but who offend are detected and tried and convicted. That's the slice that we know about, which is, you know, a little bit of a smaller slice each time I describe that. So those are the best numbers we have. When you compare that to the number of people that, you know, who are in any way open about it, clearly a massive number of people, particularly especially men, are keeping secrets. And I think some of them are keeping that secret to the grave. And sometimes they're going to the grave early because that secret's so hard to keep.
A lot of paedophiles say that they were molested as children. Were you molested as a child?
No, I wasn't. And that is true of quite a number of us. I don't have figures on it, but certainly some of us, you know, there's a lot of child abuse in the world, and therefore it's as likely as for anybody that a pedophile might have been abused as a child. Only some of us who have had that experience will say this is the reason. Maybe one or two people will say, yeah, it was like normalized for me, or it was sort of, you know, made a it became a routine thing and I therefore considered it normal. But a lot of people would just say, no, they're separate things. I did have that experience. I was abused as a child, but I don't believe that my pedophilia has come from that place. And in my case, of course, and in the case of lots of other people, there was no such abuse. And therefore we can't point at that and say, oh, well, that's the reason, because it didn't happen.
If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking to Bly Reed. Bly is a pedophile. He is a non-offending pedophile. What does that mean?
We have two different meanings, I suppose, for that in a way. So non-offending obviously means that you don't break laws. And so the most important part of that is obviously that if you're a non-offending pedophile, it would mean that you do not molest children. You don't get involved sexually with children and you don't try to. Obviously, other kinds of offending might involve images online. I'm also a non-offending pedophile in that sense, and have never accessed illegal images of children online. Even nowadays, the offending can include things like fictional material as well, because increasingly that sort of stuff is being criminalized in a lot of different jurisdictions, and so a person could be offending in that sense. So it's a word that can have different meanings, and there are also people who perhaps have offended in the past and who don't offend now and wouldn't wish to ever offend again. And of course, they are currently non-offending pedophiles, even if they maybe have an offending history. So it's a subtle definition. But basically, there are a lot of us who really have never offended. And I think a lot of people find it difficult to imagine that we exist.
If you're in a personal relationship, do you tell your partner that you're a pedophile?
I have been in that situation, and I didn't for many years. And in my particular case, the relationship came to an end because I sort of decided it wasn't compatible for me to pursue that relationship and to do what I'm doing right now on your program, which is to talk about it publicly, because obviously there's a risk of, you know, I'm using my voice and I wouldn't want any partner of mine to suffer from the stigma that might come from what I'm doing now. But for the average pedophile, they are going to face that choice. And there are two situations they might be in. They might be an exclusive pedophile. In other words, they can't really feel sexual attraction to an adult. That means that if they get together with a partner, they're going to be a little bit like, I suppose, a gay man who's married a woman, you know, to disguise the fact that he's gay. And that's going to be a very tough situation for their partner if that causes difficulties. There's also the situation that you might be a non-exclusive like me, and it's quite possible for you to have a loving, normal, if you like, relationship with another adult. And then in a way, that's great, right? That solves the problem. But as you say, it doesn't really completely solve the problem, because there's always going to be something, unless you tell them from the get-go, that they don't know about you and that they may feel like they love you unconditionally. But until they know that one key thing, you're not going to find out really whether that love really is unconditional, whether actually it's just a bridge too far. And you could understand why it would be for a lot of people. That's very challenging, because when do you bring it up? Do you go on a date and introduce yourself and say, hi, I'm, you know, I like long walks in the country and Carver and I also have a sexual attraction to children, by the way. Or do you mention it on the second date or the third or the fifth? Or do you mention it when the person mentions getting engaged, or do you mention it when the person is standing at the altar, or do you mention it a year in? Do you wait until it becomes, I'm using sort of air quotes here, you know, when it becomes a problem, in as much as you might sort of, I don't know, you might decide that you're going to, because the sexual life that you've got may not be quite satisfying enough. This sometimes happens a few years into a partnership, right? You know, you might go and look at some images. They may be legal images, but you might look at them online. And then, you know, what happens if suddenly the search history gets found and so on? There isn't really any single point when it's the sort of right moment to bring it up. And so as a result, people don't for years and years. And some of us, I think probably most of us who are in my situation, will just die without it ever being known. You know, they'll just keep it a secret forever. I think a lot of people listening to this, and I've certainly discussed this on Twitter and had people come back to me and say, well, tough, good, okay, that's, what's the problem? Don't talk about it, just shut up. And that works. I'm in my 40s now. That worked for me for, you know, a couple of decades. Eventually, I just couldn't not talk about it to at least somebody. And in my case, that obviously spiraled into sort of wanting to talk about it in public. And of course, at that point, what reasonable partner is going to stand by you necessarily? Some do. Some are amazing, but it's a big ask, huge ask, and you can't ask it of just anyone.
It's very significant what you're saying, because you're saying that pedophilia isn't a choice, just like being gay isn't a choice. Nobody chooses to be gay.
That's right.
Nobody chooses to be a pedophile.
Yeah.
So is the difference between yourself and an offending pedophile purely the choice not to molest?
That seems to be the critical thing. clearly there is some element of choice and some element of volition in, you know, whether one offends. And offending we did think of as a very sort of binary thing. You either do it or you don't, because that's how the law, you know, ultimately views it when it comes to a trial. Did this person offend? Did they break the law? Did they not? It gets very black and white. But obviously there are a lot of stages that people go through on the way to, you know, to getting to a point where a court of law would say that they had broken the law. And so that's a series of choices, you know. And for those who study this, and this is not definitely my expert area, I'll say again, but those who study this, you know, talk about a series of disinhibitions that can apply. Some people also have very compulsive thoughts and have very, you know, find self-control very difficult for reasons of pure biology and to do with their brains are built. And so it's an open and live question what blame you can assign to those people. But that sort of goes beyond my pay grade, if you like, to comment on that. I know that I did have a choice and that I've been in situations once or twice, not very often, where I've had some kind of choice, you know, to just take a step in one direction or to take or to not take that step. And my choice has been to not take that step. Other people have found themselves in a position where they've taken a few steps and they've regretted it and they've come back from that. Other people have taken quite a lot of steps and maybe even broken one or two laws, for example, in the, you know, the area of child sexual abuse material, especially. And then they've come away from that as well. It's always choices. So it's not simply a case of, you know, you make the choice once and done and dusted. Actually, I mean, for me, it sort of was a little bit like that in the sense that I, you know, I made quite a choice early on to try and sort of stay out of any situations where I might get into something worrying. And that was quite a sort of firm choice. Other people, they might be much earlier on in processing the whole thing of the fact that they're a pedophile. They might be in denial. There's all kinds of reasons they could get into difficult situations. So anyway, yeah, short answer. No, it's not a choice to become a pedophile. It's only something you can realize or not realize or deny or not deny. And in terms of becoming an offender, that's a series of choices.
Well, I think it's an important question to ask in terms of understanding that somebody can be a pedophile and not an offender.
Yeah.
It's also important to acknowledge that if somebody chooses to become an offender, then we need to look at how we prosecute such a person.
Yes. Obviously, the law, you know, is set up to protect children, and prosecutions ensue when children aren't protected. You know, we've certainly got no quarrel with that existing. We, along with other organisations, you know, we would probably question like the extent to which once somebody's been through that process, you know, how well they're supported to not reoffend. And we know there are lots of sort of mechanisms in lots of different countries which tend to increase the ostracism that those people experience once they've come through the system. And so, you know, there's reasonable debate about that. But yes, I mean, what we virtuous pedophiles support is pedophiles knowing the law and being law abiding, because that is what one expects of any responsible citizen. You know, we're not different in that respect. We don't expect exceptional treatment at all. You know, the law is for everybody, and people should obey it.
As a non-offending pedophile, do you find there is an expectation from society that if you are a pedophile, that you're automatically going to be an offender?
Yes, that assumption is very common indeed. To the extent that, again, when I first started on this, I went on Twitter and had an account. It's not possible to do that anymore. And would talk about this. People would say, yes, but, you know, obviously you're saying this in public, but really in the background, presumably you're doing illegal things. And obviously, why should I believe that you're not, you know? Which is a very difficult situation to be in, because of course, how on earth are you going to prove it? What would satisfy any person that you're not doing illegal things? There's no threshold of proof. You know, if you say, well, come and look at my computer, they say, oh, well, you've got a hard drive somewhere. If you say, well, come and look at all my hard drives, they say, oh, well, you've got an encrypted folder somewhere. And if you say, you know, and so on and so on, it just, there's no, basically people want to believe that there's one kind of pedophile, which is the offending kind. And they just don't, it doesn't interest them that there might be somebody who doesn't fit that stereotype. And I'm not surprised by that, because I'm gay and I came out as gay quite an early age, and I encountered all of the exact same assumptions and ideas in a different form, you know, around that. So yes, we do get lumped in with those who offend. And it's even more complicated than that, because those who offend are actually quite a diverse population when you look at them as well. You know, if you speak to experts who work on this, on prevention and so on, they will tell you that there's a big range of reasons why people do this kind of offending. So if you're like me and you just haven't done any of it, I think one other interesting thing is, you began the episode by saying that, you know, you wanted to understand pedophilia in the context of the fact that everybody needs to understand how does child abuse happen. Well, obviously I can tell you my perspective on that, but I'm not an offender, so I can't tell you how offenders think, because I don't have experience personally of that. I've spoken to some people who have in the past. And so in some ways you're always going to get a bit stereotyped with people assuming there's one way of being a pedophile, and therefore you're going to know, you know, if you meet one, you've met them all. But it's not true, as it's not true of any minority, you know.
We only get to know who is a pedophile by the fact that there has been a child in our communities that has been molested. So yes. We only get to know the offending pedophiles. We don't get to know the non-offending pedophiles.
That's right. And in fact, it's even more complicated than that, because when a child is sexually abused, there are known to be at least two different kinds of offenders, broadly speaking, which is to say there are situational offenders, and they are people who aren't pedophiles and who aren't attracted to children, but do abuse children. That can be for all kinds of reasons, such as lack of an adult partner or alcoholism, and they get drunk and they do something unwise, or it can describe young offenders who are young teenagers or even younger who sexually molest other children. So you have situational offenders who are not pedophiles but will be called pedophiles if they commit an offence. And you do have, of course, pedophilic offenders who are motivated by attraction. And so actually, when you say, you know, the only time we hear about these pedophiles is actually probably half of the people you're hearing about as pedophiles aren't pedophiles, whereas a lot of the people you never think of as pedophiles actually are, but just are non-offending. So it's really, I think it's very difficult for people to get their heads around how complex that is, just as I've stated it there, even before you get into the subtleties.
Is there a checklist? How do you know that you're a pedophile?
Okay, so there's two ways of thinking about this. One of them is the professionals, if they're looking for a thing called pedophilic disorder, which is when somebody is both pedophilically inclined and it causes problems, either because they hurt other people or because it causes distress for them. They would use those sorts of diagnostic criteria. But essentially, if I was talking to somebody new who came to Virtuous Pedophiles and they were sort of wondering, am I really a pedophile? What the word pedophile means in its dictionary sense and in its scientific sense is this: somebody who is not themselves a prepubescent child, but who is sexually attracted towards prepubescent children. And by prepubescent, obviously that tends to mean, it depends, different for girls and different for boys, but obviously we're talking sort of, you know, before the age of 12, before the age of 11 or the age of puberty onset. There is a separate word for people who are sexually attracted to those who are just beginning puberty, which is hebephile. And there is a separate word again for those who are attracted to teenagers, like people in the midst of adolescence, and that is ephebophile. And there's even a separate word for those attracted to very young children, which is nepiophile. So if we were talking about what is a pedophile, then I would say it's someone who's got a sexual interest in prepubescent children. And even some scientists would say it doesn't just have to be that. It has to be that that's their principal sexual interest. In other words, if you're equally attracted to adults, then maybe you don't count as a pedophile. But if you're mainly attracted to children, then you do. So it's a lot of different labels. What's the litmus test, if there is one? It's fundamentally this idea of sexual attraction. In other words, if you look at a particular, not just any child, obviously, but you know, if there are specific children who you would look at and you would feel attraction to, in the same way that a teleophilic person attracted to adults, would look at them. So imagine you're a teleophile, you're not attracted to every single adult you see. Certainly you might be attracted to one gender particularly, or it might be both, or it might be the same gender. You're going to be attracted not to every single person in that gender group, but it's going to be a small set of those people. and they might have particular features. They'd be handsome in some way, in your mind. It would set off that attraction. And it really operates very similarly for pedophiles as far as I can tell. And I am in a position to compare the two because I am also teleophilic. So that attraction can be romantic without a strong sexual element, but it can be sexual without a romantic element, or it can be both. You can't generalize beyond that, really. That's what we're saying, is that somebody has an attraction and that attraction gives them sexual feelings. That's pretty much it for pedophilia.
Are there pedophiles who cannot have satisfactory sex with adults and need to have sex with children?
I don't know about need to have, because obviously there are alternatives, but there are pedophiles who can't really feel a sexual attraction towards adults, yes. For their sexual satisfaction, it's a very interesting question as to what they can do, which is ethical. They can, in my opinion, they can fantasize, because fantasizing is not the same thing as hurting a child in real life. Some people would say they can use fictional materials, and research is ongoing as to whether that makes it, for example, more likely that they might actually offend, or less likely, because it's a satisfactory outlet. In the same way as we have that question for adult pornography, we have that same question for fictional materials that pedophiles might use. And of course, some would go towards illegal material, which would be, for example, video or photographic material that's illegal to look at. I think the bigger problem that they face really is the loneliness that comes with the fact that it's difficult for them to pursue adult relationships. It's difficult for them to be honest with anybody about this, because I've been in relationships and I've been out of relationships, and the loneliness of being out of one is quite difficult, as it is for anybody else who's in the same situation. I think the worry for those people is simply that if they have no outlet at all, that's going to be a very miserable life for them. And I think we need to think a little bit about that. We don't have to think about it in terms of doing anything that would put children in danger, because I and Virtuous Pedophiles as an organization would never prioritize sexual satisfaction for anybody over the safety of a child. On the other hand, can you really live a life totally without any kind of outlet? And that's a question that we get asked a lot, and it's difficult to come up with answers.
You raised the point about pornography. Do you think that there's a direct relationship between pedophilia and pornography?
No, I don't see an obvious relationship between it, between the two things. In other words, it could be possible. Like, for example, I've never been interested in telephilic pornography, as it happens. It's an unusual sort of situation to be in, but it just so happens that that's my situation. And so, I never really made any kind of journey through any of that sort of material, and it doesn't seem to have affected the fact that I'm a pedophile. Other people, I suppose more normal people, would be more likely to make use of adult pornography. We do sometimes get approached at Virtuous Pedophiles by people who describe that they've made a journey through different kinds of pornography, starting with adult pornography, and that they've gradually, we call them edge seekers. They've gradually looked for things which, standard pornography isn't quite exciting enough, so they look for something a little bit more racy, they look for something that's a little bit more explicit or edgy, and eventually, through going through that process, they eventually come upon pictures, of children. It's difficult to say, having spoken to a few of those people, whether they are motivated by an intrinsic attraction for children. They might be a bit more like situational contact offenders, in the sense that their motivations are different. They're seeking that edge. But that isn't a phenomenon that I know a great deal about, other than that I've spoken to three or four people, with that, who have that journey. Their journey is definitely distinct from my one, where I started with it just happening in my head, and it didn't, I didn't seek pornography about it, but the fantasies were still there. So I don't think we're going to find that there's a really simple relationship between pornography users and pedophilia, but I do think there are some people who use adult pornography and then, for want of a better word, graduate to illegal material, but they may not be pedophiles, those people.
If you've just joined me, I'm Kathy Kaler. This is Community in Conversation. My guest this morning is Bly Reed. He is a non-offending pedophile. Bly, is pedophilia a choice?
No, I don't think it's a choice. It certainly hasn't felt like a choice to me. I think it's something that you realize, in the same way that I think is true of pretty much everybody who has a sexual attraction. In fact, even with some of the sexual attractions that we think of as highly unusual, when you talk to people who have them, they don't tend to describe any process of choice. You know, this idea of sort of, I don't know, going on the internet and looking at the catalogs and sorting through the competing choices and thinking, oh, rationally, it would be best for me to have this particular sexuality or preference or whatever you want to call it. So no, it's not a choice. And some people really find it very difficult to live with. In fact, I think some people don't live with it. I think they die. I think they kill themselves. And others happily, in my opinion, find a way to, you know, live a life that's free of offending, but also where they don't continually feel like they need to stop living.
Your life would have been so much simpler if you had never said anything about being a pedophile. Why come out and talk about it?
A lot of us don't. I think most of us don't, which is why, in a way, this conversation is necessary in this context. Why am I doing it specifically? I'm one of very few people who will. I'm doing it because I think it's misunderstood. I mean, my background is that I realized when I was 11 that I was gay, and I came out at school when I was 13. And so I went through a whole process of people disbelieving me. You're too young. How can you possibly know? Well, you know, that's not normal. Why have you chosen this? All of these many questions I heard back then. And so when later on I realized I was a pedophile as well, I started to apply that same logic and to think, you know, well, with homosexuality, we had decades of when you just, and I'm not making a comparison between the two things, but just to say we had these decades of when you couldn't talk about this subject because everybody was afraid. And also with child sexual abuse, if you were a victim of child sexual abuse, we've had decades and decades where you couldn't talk about it because everyone was afraid of the whole subject. I'm not making a comparison there either, but we know over and over again that people who are forced to keep a secret have a more difficult lifestyle. And in some ways they get driven underground and they get driven away from society and they become ostracized. By talking in the way I'm talking about this now, I'm having to ostracize myself. I've decided to cut off different friends and, you know, to sort of not have the same relationships with the world that I used to have because I'm just scared that other people are going to get, you know, if there's any consequences for me speaking out, that those consequences could affect other people in my life that I love. And so it is a very difficult choice to have made and not one that I've done lightly. And I'm doing it in the knowledge that most people who hear what I have to say are going to reject it or dismiss it. And it won't have been worth saying it almost to those people because they don't want to hear the narrative I've got, or they want to believe something else about people like me. So in some ways, the answer to your question, why I do it, is like, you're right, it's absolutely a crazy thing to do. Why on earth would anyone do it? And I sometimes wonder myself. But I believe that there needs to be a conversation about this, because if there isn't a conversation about this, there's going to be possibly more child abuse. Why aren't we talking to you about the fact that we're pedophiles? Because we are terrified of the consequences for ourselves, even if we've done nothing wrong. We're terrified for the consequences it might have for you, because if we share that secret with you, you've got a burden to carry, and we're scared of you having to carry that burden, because you're going to be worried about us. Okay, first thing, I have come out to some people who were not pedophiles in my life, and usually, quite quickly, they will ask, you're not in any trouble, are you? You've not done anything wrong. That's the first question they ask, okay? If someone else comes out as some other secret to someone else, they don't usually start by just checking whether you've broken the law or not. They usually start by just saying, are you okay? How are you feeling about this? Thank you for telling me. Some people do that brilliantly, but other people, it's just like, what does this mean for me? Oh my God, you've told me this. We have to not, you can't tell anybody else. You mustn't, you know, these terrible, terrible fears, they add up to an omerta that you cannot go outside of. And that feels, I think, for people, like, ultimately it feels a bit like you're in a sort of an invisible prison. That psychologically is very isolating. And I think it leads people to a lot of mental health problems, I think, and I think ultimately death for some people. I certainly have planned suicide in the past and even got some stages towards achieving it. And I know I'm not alone in that. In fact, I think we did a survey of the virtuous pedophiles community, and I think 25% have made a suicide attempt, and that's not counting the others who've thought a lot about suicide or who've often had suicidal thoughts. There are a few people who are supportive out in the sort of, as it were, the real world. There are obviously the scientists who are getting to understand this better. There are people who are sort of are mainly actually often they've begun by being engaged with victims of child sexual abuse, and they've understood how big a problem that is before they've gone on to ask the same questions you're asking, like what can be done and can this be done by understanding instead of by just condemning. And I think that's encouraging to see.
Joining me this morning is Bly Reed. He is a paedophile, and he's helping you and I to understand paedophilia. He is a non-offending paedophile. He's part of a group called Virtuous Paedophiles. Bly, tell us a little bit about Virtuous Paedophiles.
So this is a group it's an organization, a very small organization that was started in 2012, so just about 10 years of activity. It grew out of another group which was called Before You Act, and there were other groups before that. Virtuous Pedophiles and some of its sort of sister organizations are what is called anti-contact. So a lot of people might remember back in the 80s and the 90s and so on, or 70s, there were pedophile organizations, but they were what we would call pro-contact. They tried to make a public argument to say that it was actually okay to sexually abuse children, or that if society changed in certain ways, it would be okay. And we don't agree with that perspective. We say, no, our belief is that it will always be a moral problem if adults try to get sexually involved with young people, regardless of the fact that we didn't choose the attraction and all of that stuff, you know. We also say, however, that if people in our position, you know, didn't choose our attractions, we haven't made a moral choice to be this way, then it is not meaningful to blame us and to treat us as if we are blameworthy simply for having the attraction. And at the moment, we talked earlier about, you know, whether I would sort of, why I would talk about this at all. And it's true. I wouldn't talk about this to a landlord. I wouldn't talk about this to an employer. I wouldn't talk about this to most of my acquaintances, because of course I know that the consequence of acknowledging this would be that I would lose the job, that I might get refused service at my GP. I might get, you know, all kinds of things could happen to me that would mean that I would be cut off further from society than I already am. And so Virtuous Pedophiles is aware that a lot of people live in that situation, and we want to raise awareness that that situation is unjust. It's unfair that we should carry the judgment of society for things that we haven't done. And we also want to make people aware that those who have offended as well, you know, there's a lot of things that need to change in terms of making sure that reoffending doesn't occur. As part of starting that little website and that campaign, and that was started by Edwards and Nick Devin, who were doing this a long time before I was, we started a small community, because pedophiles have always gathered online, and they've gathered online in different contexts. Some pedophiles gather online because they want to share illegal material, and that happens. A lot of us instead, however, are reaching out for companionship and support by people who will not cut us off the minute we admit this. And so speaking to other pedophiles is logical. So we started a forum for that, but because we know that some pedophiles will want to do what they're used to doing in other spaces, we set up a lot of rules. Among the rules are that, first of all, to join us, you have to be committed to never having sexual activity with a child. You have to agree to and observe the rule that you will not talk in an arousing way about children when you post about your situation. And we don't allow posting pictures at all of any kind, whether they're illegal or not. So people don't do that in our group either. Effectively, our forum is there for people to talk about the experience of being a pedophile. And a lot of what comes up will be people talking, for example, getting advice on, like, they're thinking about coming out to a family member and they're not quite sure how to tackle it. So we have a lot of people who've been through that experience and can give them some guidance. A lot of people are saying, I want to find a therapist who would help me with this, but I don't know who to trust, because therapists are not very well educated about this in general. And so sometimes people come along saying, I tried to come out to my therapist, but they just fired me as a client and told me to go away and told me that it was really impossible for them to treat me and so on. You know, we hear a lot of those sorts of stories. There are now also organizations. One is ASAP International, Before You Act as well, that I mentioned before. They also will refer pedophiles to therapists who can cope with that kind of client and who understand the context. And also we hear a lot from people who are afraid of mandatory reporting, because although in most countries what mandatory reporting should mean is that if someone goes into a therapist's office and says, I have abused a child, and here, you know, and this child was this person particularly, it was my nephew or it was whoever, you know, they would be obliged to make a report upwards to the police. However, there is a matter of discretion in this. So for example, if someone comes into a therapist's office and the therapist hasn't dealt with this before and they say, I'm attracted to children and there are children in my family, even though they're not saying that they've abused or done anything inappropriate with those children, that therapist might go, I better be safe than sorry. I better just let my supervisor and the police know about this person. And then before you know it, suddenly there's some investigation happening against this person who hasn't done anything wrong. And investigations being what they are, you know, the moment there is smoke, people assume that there is a fire, and it can lead to all the same consequences as if you had done something wrong. And that's a problem in our system. So people ask for our advice about that, and we link them with places where they're unlikely to undergo that kind of experience, where therapists who've worked with this actually make sensible, logical, risk-based judgments that are proportionate to the situation that they're dealing with. It's not to say that the therapist is still obliged to mandatory report if someone's reporting a crime, of course.
Do you have children in your own family?
No, I don't at this moment. It has been the case in the past, and I've had perfectly good, sensible relations with those kids. I've been lucky in that I've never happened to be attracted to any of them, so that's been helpful. I have known one or two children who I have been attracted to, like I've known them personally, you know, family, friends and whatnot. And again, it hasn't caused a problem. So in other words, I've interacted in the same way that any, I think, other person would interact with. You know, I've been friendly to those kids. That's been the thing. I think I'm a bit frightened to go into this, but I'm going to. But of course, the anxiety at the back of my mind is, of course, oh, everyone's thinking I was really grooming them and I was doing sort of terrible things, you know, and stuff like that. But that wasn't the case at all. You know, I've done my reading and I've had my sort of training about things and appropriate ways to, you know, to interact with children. And I'm really, hand on heart, sure that, you know, I never did anything that a person would consider objectionable or even questionable, really, in those areas. So sometimes we hear via the Virtuous Pedophiles Forum that some people are a bit concerned that they've got a child in their life that they are attracted to and that they want to make sure they keep it appropriate, or, you know, that they're concerned that they've, for example, said something or, you know, or stared too much on the street or something like that, you know. And some people, I think, you know, because the way our society is so terrified of the accusation, whether it's true or not, of being in that way attracted, I think a lot of us get into absolute panics about it that perhaps are a bit needless. You know, you can walk down the street and see somebody that you're attracted to, and that's kind of the end of that episode, isn't it? You know, married people who are faithful or monogamous, they walk down the street and they, of course, see people that are more attractive than their wife, than their husband, you know, in their minds, and they deal with it in their minds. It doesn't become some gigantic crisis. And for those for whom it does become some gigantic crisis, well, you know, there are more factors in play there. You know, maybe there's a reason why it goes in that direction.
I think again, Bly, is that the only paedophiles that we ever get to know are the offenders, and only one child has been molested.
That's right. And they've gone so far beyond those normal lines, you know. I mean, when I'm talking about the lines that I've been conscious of, I'm talking about just being very careful about sort of just not talking in an inappropriate way in front of a child. I'm not talking about sort of worrying about touching them in a particular way or, you know, anything really up to the edge like that. And so, yes, you're right. And actually, I think in some ways, you know, abusers, those who really are determined to abuse, and those who are actually, you know, trying to make a path for themselves where they can abuse, they can rely on this silence a little bit as well, because silence is the friend of abuse. In other words, if people are so inhibited because it's such a huge accusation to say, oh, I saw the way you touched so-and-so's back or something like that earlier, and I wondered, would you mind not doing that in the future? You'd be so terrified of saying that to a man, because how much offense would he take if he's just a regular heterosexual guy, or even if he's not, you know, that you're sort of implying that maybe he's sexually interested in this child. You know, it's such a nuclear bomb to drop on someone that we actually avoid getting there. And so those who are intent on abuse can perhaps even rely on that embarrassment threshold a little bit in order to carry out that abuse.
Why, if somebody listening to this right now is a pedophile and has offended, what do you say to them?
First of all, you know, we're not the police, but we would like them to, depending on the offence, we think that they, you know, there are consequences that should be faced for that. And we would encourage them to talk in whatever way they can to somebody about that experience. In some cases, really egregious offences, it's going to be impossible for them to avoid some legal consequences if they do talk to somebody about it. And we can't make them do that, because people only approach us anonymously. We can just say, here are the options you've got. If they have offended in the past and it's been through the legal system, and they are very determined that they should not offend again, but they're concerned that it might happen again, that's when we would say, well, this is where therapy can help you, because it could provide that support. We would refer them off to, for example, asapinternational.org. We might refer them off to beforeyouact.org. And indeed, there are many other, in each country, there are many other efforts to reach those who feel like they might be at risk of offending. We would say, the thing is, a lot of people, you know, what I got shouted at me a lot when I was on Twitter was get help. And of course, just saying get help raises the whole question of, well, what help is available? So what those people in that situation need is someone who knows what help is available.
What advice would you give to children?
What advice would I give to children? I think that the advice that's out there is not bad advice at the moment, because effectively what we're looking for is behaviors, not necessarily attractions. That's what's going to give people guidance about sort of, you know, who's a safe person to talk to. I'm actually going to talk about two sets of children. One is the set of children who, you know, who might be at risk of, and the most likely place that they're going to encounter a situation like that is either, of course, within their family or their friend group. As we know, that's the most common place for abuse to take place. Or, of course, it might happen online with grooming and stuff like that. And to be honest, they're not going to find self-identified pedophiles in those situations. You know, it's going to be rather the reverse. But obviously, you know, if a conversation turns sexual quickly or turns onto sexual topics and you're not comfortable with that, then you can and should withdraw from that conversation, and you could speak to somebody about it, you know, that you trust. That's the same advice I think that children already have about this. I'm going to talk to another set of children, however, now, who might be, for example, 14 years old and have just realized they have these sorts of feelings themselves, because they're not going to sit in a class and be given advice about this in the way that all children are given advice about online stranger danger, etc. What advice can I give to them? Because we're an 18 plus organization, so we can't directly engage with children, which we don't do for ethical reasons. There's a website that's just recently been created called whatsok.org. It's in the States. And it's run by professionals. It's not run by pedophiles. And it's has a helpline attached to it. And I would recommend that they start by checking that website out. There are other ways that they can talk to people, but they are in a very difficult situation, those kids, because they might be very frightened of telling their parents, their whole network, their family, their church, their synagogue, any of those sorts of situations. So they have a lot of self-protecting to do, and unfortunately most adults are not going to help them with that. And that's a situation I would like to see change. Visit that website, What's Okay, because for the first time, and this website only launched just last year, for the first time, there are professionals who understand this issue, who can talk to you and not instantly panic, condemn you, tell you're the worst person in the world, tell you you've got to stop it, any of these things. So I'd like, that's the message I need people to hear.
Something that I think society needs to really check itself on its beliefs is that pedophiles are not nasty people. They wouldn't be able to do that if they weren't charismatic.
Yeah, and I think
the grooming process is about winning the trust of the child, getting closer, developing an intimate relationship. There's a huge amount of betrayal that goes with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're making quite an important distinction, because I think actually there's actually quite a big spectrum of those who offend against children. Again, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but certainly you will have, you know, at one extreme, highly ruthless, highly non-empathetic individuals who are very sort of driven by a specific desire. It may even be a desire to hurt more than it's a desire to behave sexually. But sex is a means to achieve that control and that power. And that's one type of abuse. You have certainly sometimes among pedophilic offenders, because those first ones may well be situational offenders. But among pedophilic offenders, you may have people who are themselves not enormously older than the victim, and who are confused by their feelings, you know, and they genuinely feel that they're in love, and that they just place a huge emotional responsibility on that young person or that child, that child is not equipped to handle. But because they're so involved in their own stuff, they end up in an abusive situation without really meaning to or feeling like that they're doing that. And I think you hear about cases like that. And further along that line, there has been some study of offending pedophiles to discover that some of them describe having what's called emotional congruence with children. And what that means is that they tend to feel almost themselves as if they are childlike, that they're like a child, that they are emotionally more like a child, and that they react and therefore they get on rather well with children because they feel that they're sort of on that same level. And that can be involved in situations that end in sexual offending. And that's an interesting thing, but I don't think many people fully understand that it can be the case. And I think what you were describing is another category again of the charismatic. So in other words, the person is grooming and it's deliberate, and that they're very charismatic and they're very charming. But they maybe don't have quite the level of empathy which enables them to stop and think, okay, in the short term, you know, in certain situations with older children particularly, they can it can seem like that the child likes the attention at the time, you know, and so they can be very deluded about that being the case, and they get very confused in it. What they're not doing is taking that step back to think, well, what are the long term consequences of this, you know, this momentary action? And of course, anything that encourages them to reflect more on that, you know, at the critical point is going to be very helpful, I hope.
Well, Irid, thank you very, very much for leveling with us. As I've said a few times, is that often the only pedophiles we get to hear about are the ones that have offended. If you would like to get in touch with the organization that Bly is involved with, it is called Virtuous Pedophiles. Their website is virped.org, virped.org. In summary, as communities, we only hear about the offending pedophiles. But clearly, not all pedophiles are offenders. Some make the choice not to molest children. While pedophilia is not a choice, molesting is a choice. Just think about that. We all have choices that we make, and we have to live with the consequences. This interview has been part of a series. In others, I will be discussing the brain science behind pedophilia. We're going to be looking at it in the South African context too, finding out how to talk to children about staying safe and how to protect our communities from any sexual offenders, including offending pedophiles. I'm doing it so that we stop whispering about it, so that we stop sweeping it under the carpet, so that we strengthen our community, and so that we have the conversations that matter. I'm Kathy Kaler for Community in Conversation on 101.9 High FM.
It's a Community in Conversation Join Kathy Kayla every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 High FM.